Today we are very pleased and privileged to host once again Dr. Mujan Momen, who is a private and independent scholar. Dr. Momen was born in Iran but raised in and educated in England attended the University of Cambridge. He's a medical doctor and has a special interest in the study of the Baha'i faith and Shi'i Islam, both from the viewpoint of their history and their doctrines. In recent years, his interest has extended to the study of the phenomena of religion. Principal publications in the field include Introduction to Shi'i Islam, The Babi and Baha'i Faith, 1844 to 1944, Some Contemporary Western Accounts, The Phenomena of Religion, The Baha'i Faith, A Short Introduction, Selection from the Writings of E.G. Brown on the Babi and Baha'i Religions, Buddhism and the Baha'i Faith, Studies in Babi and Baha'i History. He also wrote and contributed articles to Encyclopedia Iranica, a distinguished Encyclopedia Iranica, Encyclopedia of the Modern Islamic World, as well as papers to academic journals such as the International Journal of Middle Eastern Studies, Past and Present, Iran and Religion. He is also fellow and member of the Royal Asiatic Society, the British Society for Middle Eastern Studies, the Society of Iranian Studies, the British Association for the Study of Religion, and the Association for Baha'i Studies. Today's lecture will deal with the attempted assassination of Nasiruddin Shah in 1852, millennialism and violence. Please, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me all right? Good. The topic of millennialism and violence has come very much to the fore in the aftermath of a number of episodes that occurred, particularly right at the end of the 20th century, leading up to the second Christian millennium. There were episodes such as the Waco tragedy in 1993, the two sets of deaths associated with the Solar Temple in Switzerland and Canada in 1994 and 1995, Aum Shinriko's release of sarin gas in the town of Matsumoto in 1994 and on the Tokyo Underground in 1995, and the Heaven's Gate group suicides in 1997. These events concentrated the minds of many scholars on the propensity for some millennialist groups to turn to violence. And in this paper, what I want to do is to look at at the events that caused a 19th century group in Iran to also commit an act of violence, which was the attempted assassination of Nasiruddin Shah in 1852. This was an attempt carried out by the Babis, the followers of the Bab, a religion that began in the 19th century and began in 1844 to be precise, started by Sayyid Ali Muhammad Shirazi, who took the title of the Bab, and the movement became known as the Babi movement. And its connection with the Baha'i faith, which is the series that this talk is being presented in, is that the Bab is regarded together with Baha'u'llah as the co-founders of the Baha'i faith. And in a period of some 6 years from 1844 to 1850, when the Bab was executed in 1850, in that period of time the Babi movement caused quite a stir in Iran. It was considered challenging both from the religious point of view, in that the Bab put forward certain claims. He claimed to be the fulfillment of Shi'i prophecies related to the coming of the arising of the 12th Imam, the return of the 12th Imam, the Imam Mahdi. He put forward certain religious claims, and these were simultaneously, in a sense, also political claims, because the Imam had both religious and political authority. And therefore, by putting forward this claim, he was making both a religious and a political claim. At least that's how it seemed to the people who heard this claim. And so consequently, the whole movement caused a great deal of turmoil in Iran. Initially, the turmoil was mainly in terms of polemic. The Iranian religious leaders in Iran, the Muslim religious leaders in Iran, condemned the new movement and started to preach against it. And initially, again, the opposition from the government was merely confining the Bab and preventing him from having free access to his followers, for example. But the Babi movement, despite this, continued to spread, and at its peak it may have had as many as 100,000 followers in Iran, which may have represented, I mean, all these figures are very vague, nobody knows what the population of Iran was at that time, but it may have been as much as 2-3% of the population of Iran. But what happened, so this was 18, I've put some key dates up on there to help us along. 1844 was the start of the Babi movement, and 4 years later, in 1848, there was a marked change in the response of the government to the Bab. The previous Shah, the previous king, Muhammad Shah, died in that year, and a new ruler, Nasiruddin Shah, came to the throne. And he and his new and the new prime minister, in particular Mirza Taghi Khan, who took the title Amir Kabir or Amir Nizam, they were very much more active in opposing the Bab. And the new prime minister, Mirza Taghi Khan, took advantage of what might have been considered a local altercation between some of the Babis and a local religious leader in Mazandaran to confront the new movement, and he sent royal troops up to support the local people in their opposition to the Babis, and he sent thousands of, in fact, troops and batteries of artillery against a handful of people. There were no more than 300 or 400 Babis collected in Mazandaran, and they were mostly students and merchants and tradespeople. And he sent thousands of royal troops against them and batteries of artillery and so on. And the first of the episodes that I've put up there, Sheikh Tabarsi, was this episode in Mazandaran, which resulted in the death of several hundred Babis. And this was followed in 1850 by two further episodes in Nehriz and Mazandaran. Nehriz and Zanjan. Nehriz being in the south of Iran and Zanjan being in the northwest on the main road between Tehran and Tabriz. And again, in both of these two episodes, thousands of royal troops, together with artillery, were sent against the Babis, resulting eventually in the death of many, a general massacre of the Babis, and the death of many hundreds of them. And in 1850, the Bab himself was executed by the orders of the Shah and of the Prime Minister. And so that's the background, if you like, to this episode that we're going to be talking about, which has occurred in 1852, so 2 years after the execution of the Bab. Now, although the Babi movement has been compared by at least one scholar to the Taiping movement in China, this doesn't seem to me a valid comparison, because the Taiping movement in China, the founder of that movement, whose name I think is pronounced as Hong Xiu Quan, was clearly intended a worldly kingdom. He clearly intended to oppose the Manchu dynasty and to overthrow the Confucian system. And a military conflict was on the cards right from the start because of what he was planning and what he's laid out as his plans. Whereas the Bab, in contrast, addressed letters to the Shah, to Muhammad Shah, who was reigning when he first started his mission in the early years of his ministry. He sent letters to him in a respectful tone and stressed that his desire was for Muhammad Shah to investigate and to champion the cause of the Bab. And even after Muhammad Shah, influenced by the then Prime Minister, had refused to meet the Bab and had imprisoned him in a remote corner of Iran, the Bab still never called on his followers to rise up against the Shah or to cause any, the Bab in his writings never called upon his followers to make any sort of opposition to the regime in Iran. And so what we're going to talk about is what happened. So during the time of the Bab, as I say, although there were these conflicts, there was no sense in which the Babis were rising up against the government, that these were mainly local conflicts that were then blown up into a major thing by the royal troops being sent against the Babis, and the Babis were for the most part defending themselves in these episodes. So up to 1850 there had been no episode, there had not really been any opposition from the Babis to the movement. The Babis were not trying to overthrow the government, and certainly the Bab himself in his writings was not trying to do anything like that. So what we're going to consider in this paper is really what happened to turn this situation around, so that in 1852 there was an attempt on the life of the Shah by the Babis, a very direct confrontation, if you like. The topic of millennialism and violence is one that's, as I say, has attracted a lot of attention, and there have been quite a few scholars now who have written on that subject. Millennialism can be defined, and has been defined by one leading scholar, as being millennialists are those who believe in a salvation that is collective, this worldly, imminent, total in the sense that it is to utterly transform life on earth, and miraculous in the sense that it is to be brought about by a supernatural means. And in Shi'i Islam, this millennialist fervor is kept very much alive and in the forefront of people's minds the whole time, because every year you have commemorations of the defeat and martyrdom of the Shi'i imams. These were 11 figures who in the years immediately after the Prophet Muhammad were the descendants of Muhammad, and whom Shi'is regard to have been the rightful rulers in Islam, but whose position was, according to the Shi'is, usurped by the caliphs, the Umayyad and later the Abbasid caliphs. And so therefore in the eyes of Shi'is, these people were wronged, their position was usurped, and they were all martyred. And in particular, the third Shi'i Imam Hussein's death is commemorated every year in the first 10 days of Muharram, the first month of the Islamic year. You have very major commemorations, recitals of the sufferings of the Imams, theatrical performances commemorating his death, and processions where people wail and beat themselves and whip themselves and so on. And these are very, very major part of Shi'i life, because it's not just those 10 days. All through the year there's the commemorations of the martyrdom of other imams. So continuously this is being brought to the minds of the Shi'is, and at the same time as these deaths are being commemorated, in the what is being reinforced is the idea that eventually the 12th Imam will return and right these wrongs. So it's in one sense a looking back, these commemorations are a looking back at the past, but at the same time they are reinforcing this millennialist idea, this millennialist fervor, that at some stage these wrongs that have been done in the past will be righted by the coming of the Imam Mahdi, and the fact that he will defeat the enemies of the Shi'is and overturn these wrongs that have been done. So in Shi'ism you have this sort of ever-present idea and being strongly reinforced all the time about this coming of the Imam who will fight a battle against the enemies of the Shi'is, defeat them, and put everything right that was put wrong in the past. one of the scholars in this field of millennialism has described two types of millennialism, which I've put up there. The catastrophic millennialism, which anticipates a sudden and usually violent overthrow of the present order by a supernatural agency, which is usually God. So in other words, that there will be a sudden and violent overturning of the order. Usually there is a messianic element to it, in the sense that some figure will arise who will do this. And you can find this sort of millennialism in Christianity, in Judaism, in Islam, and even in Buddhism. And the other type of millennialism is what Catherine Wessinger calls the progressive type of millennialism, which looks to a gradual improvement in human circumstances, carried out generally by human beings, even though it may be under the guidance of a superhuman agency, but basically a gradual change. So you have the catastrophic millennialism, which is a violent, sudden change and overthrow, and a progressive millennialism, which is a gradual improvement in human circumstances. And if in this classification, Islam clearly falls into the catastrophic variety, in that the coming of the 12th Imam will bring about an apocalyptic battle in which the forces of the Imams, the forces of good, will be ranged against the forces of evil, and they will be defeated, and the earth will be filled with justice by the triumph of the Imam. So, as I say, Islam clearly falls into this catastrophic description that Catherine Wessinger has given. But what we find in the writings of the Bab is that he was trying to shift his followers away from this catastrophic millennialism into more the progressive type. In his writings, you find that he is interpreting all of these apocalyptic events that will occur in spiritual and metaphoric terms. He talks about the resurrection of the dead being a spiritual resurrection. He talks about spiritual victory rather than physical victory, and so on. And he is trying to, in his writings, to get his followers to follow ethical values. He talks about the setting up of a Babi state. His idea is that it will be through the agency of the Babis that the world will be transformed. So he's moving the Babis, who come from this Shi'i cultural background, away from this catastrophic view into this more progressive view. But the problem is that the Bab's message has difficulty in diffusing through to his followers. Although there was this very rapid expansion of the numbers of the Babis, it's fairly clear that the actual teachings of the Bab diffuse through to his followers very much with a great deal more difficulty. Firstly, because the Bab himself was confined right from the start of his ministry. He was confined to one extent or another when he was in Shiraz, when he was in Esfahan, and more particularly towards the end of his ministry when he was imprisoned in Marku and Chehriq. He was in prison. There were guards to actually prevent his followers from getting in. And so whatever he was writing and the message he was trying to get across had a great deal of difficulty getting through to his followers. And his writings were in Arabic, and his followers were for a large part in Arabic, and his followers were Iranians, most of whom didn't read the Arabic. And so, although the Bab, as I say, was trying to make this movement, we could be fairly sure that the vast majority of his followers remained culturally rooted in their Shi'i background of a sort of vision of a sort of catastrophic type of millennialism. I've already described the fact that the Babis had these series of defeats between 1848 and 1850 at Sheikh Tabarsi and Nehriz and Zanjan. And then the Bab himself was executed in 1850. And if we now look to how the Babis saw themselves in, say, late 1850, at the end of all of this, there's no doubt that the Babis saw these defeats, saw the events, particularly at Sheikh Tabarsi, as being in a sense reenactments of the events of the past. In other words, that the defeats that they had suffered were to a certain extent seen as reenactments of the episode of Karbala, when the Imam Hussein had been martyred, and so they saw their own defeats as being reenactments of these episodes. I'm going to read out for you the words which have been put into the mouth of one of the military leaders of the royal forces who was sent against the Babis at Sheikh Tabarsi. One of the Babi Baha'i historians puts the following words into the mouth of the military leader of the forces sent against the Babis, reflecting on the episode afterwards. He says, "The truth of the matter is that anyone who had not seen Karbala," which is where the Imam Hussein was martyred, "anyone who had not seen Karbala would, if he had seen Tabarsi, not only comprehended what took place there, but would have ceased to regard Karbala at all. And had he seen Mullah Hussein," who was the Babi leader at Sheikh Tabarsi, "he would have been convinced that the chief of martyrs, the Imam Hussein, had returned to earth. And had he witnessed my deeds," in other words, he himself, the leader of the forces against the Babis, "had he seen my deeds, he would assuredly have said, 'This is Shemr, who was the killer of the Imam Hussein, come back with sword and lance.'" And this quotation points to a very important doctrinal feature in all of this, which is that the Bab very much, very strongly in his writings and in his doctrine, reinforced this idea of return, that the people who enacted these dramas in the time of the Bab were the return of the people who in the previous age had been the Imam Hussein and his followers on one side, and Yazid, the Umayyad Caliph, and Shemr, the killer of the Imam Hussein, on the other side. So it was very much, spiritually speaking, an enactment of the previous episode, and these people were the return of those previous people who fought on the two sides. So this sort of doctrinal element reinforced, if you like, this feeling that these were apocalyptic battles being fought. And so it wasn't just that the Shah was being compared to Yazid, he actually was the return of Yazid, if you like. It wasn't just that the Babis, he was the return of Yazid, who had ordered the death of the Bab, and the people who had carried out his orders were Shemr, who had carried out the killing of the Imam Hussein. And this, of course, then stirred up within the followers of the Bab all of these feelings that they had about these episodes at Karbala, and years of cultural indoctrination, you might say, of the evils of the people who had fought against the Imam Hussein, and how it was the duty of everyone to fight against these people, and so on. So, looking at what the position was of the Babi movement at the end of 1850, after the execution of the Bab, and at the end of these episodes of where they'd been defeated, we can see that they had this very strong feeling that they were part of this thing, that the first phase had ended in defeat, but that didn't necessarily mean complete defeat, because there was other figures expected, as well as the return of the Imam Mahdi, the 12th Imam. It was expected that all of the other Imams would also return. There would be a return of the Imam Hussein. There would be the coming of the return of Jesus Christ. All of these figures would return. And so it wasn't, there was this expectation that this battle, if you like, would carry on until eventual victory. The execution of the Bab himself undoubtedly removed one of the major restraining forces on the Babis, because, as I say, the Bab himself had always written in such a way as to minimize these violent tendencies, if you like. He had himself refrained from any provocative statements in his writings that might be considered in any way to promote violence, and he had never, for example, called for a jihad or anything like that, although in his writings he had allowed for jihad, he had never himself called for that, which he could easily have done after, say, the Sheikh Tabarsi episode. He had never promoted any of this, and with his removal, with his execution, and with the removal at these episodes of Sheikh Tabarsi in particular, but also Zanjan and Nehriz, of the top echelon of the Babi movement, the people who thoroughly understood what the Bab, if you like, was trying to say, you had a situation in which the Babis were cast adrift, the top layer of leadership had been removed, and they were back, sort of cast back on their own resources, which tended, as I say, to have this very apocalyptic ideas from their Shi'i background about what was happening, about the what they were involved with was an apocalyptic battle against the forces of evil. Okay, so what I want to do then is to now concentrate on what was happening in Tehran, because this episode that happened in 15th of August 1852, the attempt on the life of Nasser al-Din Shah, was very much something that happened among the Tehran Babis, and this numbered the Tehran Babis, as far as I can make out, probably numbered, say, between 200 and 300 people. And it was very much something that happened among this group of Babis. Now, the vast majority of Babis were not involved in this. This was a small number of Babis, and as I'll come on to show, it's actually even a smaller number than 200 or 300. It's a small subgroup among the Tehran Babis that this whole thing emerged out of. So how did it come about that a movement that up to 1850 had been primarily only reacting defensively against attacks upon it, whose leader, the Bab, had never called for an uprising, had never called for a jihad, had never written encouraging his followers to in any way come out in any sort of violence against the existing regime. How is it that this group of people went on 2 years later to actually make an attempt on the life of the Shah? And in particular, then, we're going to now concentrate on what was happening among the Tehran Babis. The sources tell us that for the first, roughly for about a six-month period, which, as far as I can tell, was probably the last half of 1850 and probably going into perhaps the first couple of months of 1851, there was a battle for leadership, a contest for leadership between two of the followers of the Bab in Tehran for the Tehran leadership. I'm not talking about now the whole country. What had happened was the top layer of the Babi movement had been removed, and so basically the Babi movement was fragmented into different local groups of Babis. There was no longer a national leadership, and in Tehran there was a contest between the for leadership between two individuals. The first was named Sheikh Ali Torshizi, who took the name Azim, and the second was a religious leader. He was a cleric from the northeastern region of Khorasan. He'd always been one of the more militant Babis. As far as we can gather, he'd tried to organize a rescue of the Bab when the latter was being taken under armed guard past Tehran. And later on, he had, during an episode which was called the Seven Martyrs of Tehran, when seven Babis had been executed in Tehran in 1850, this whole episode may have been partly caused when certain plans he made that he was hatching were discovered by a government spy, although I'm not myself quite clear whether he actually was hatching this plot or whether it was a government spy making up this plot, because there's not a lot about it in the Babi sources, so I'm not sure whether the plot actually existed or not. But if it did, he was certainly the person who was the leader of the plot in 1850. So anyway, he was one of the more militant figures, let's say. And the other contender for leadership was Sayyid Basir Ehendi, a blind Indian who was, by all accounts, a compelling orator, and asserted that his writings were inspired by the Bab. We understand that he was mixing Hindu beliefs regarding reincarnation together with a claim to be the return of the Imam Hussein. And for 6 months, there was, a competition between these two contesting the leadership of the leader of the Babis in Tehran. And it appears that Azim must have won, since Sayyid Basir then left Tehran for Esfahan, and he was later executed in late 1851 in southwest of Iran. Another contender for leadership in Tehran was Mirza Yahya Nuri, who had the title of Azal. He had a number of letters from the Bab that appeared to bestow on him a certain degree of leadership, but from the accounts that we have, he appears to have deferred to Azim in the leadership of the Tehran Babis. And although he tried to maintain some independent authority, his youth, he was only about 20 years of age at this time, would have made it impossible for him to assert very much leadership in the presence of a figure like Azim, who was very much a senior cleric and very respected figure and so on. And another person who never formally put forward a claim of leadership at this time was Mirza Hossein Ali Nuri, who was at this time known by the title of Baha and later took the title of Baha'u'llah and became the founder of the Baha'i faith. At this time he did not put forward any claim to leadership, but he was in many ways the organizer or one of the main organizers of the Tehran group. His home in Tehran was a meeting place for the Babis and a resident for Baha'i Babi travelers who were coming through Tehran from other parts of Iran. His wealth financed many of the Babi activities and supported those Babis who had been made destitute by the persecutions in other parts of Iran and who had come to Tehran. So there was these four or so people contesting the leadership, and insofar as I can make out what was happening, by early 1851, Tehran Babis had divided into two camps. On the one side, there were those who wanted to continue the struggle, wanted to achieve a military victory in the sort of mold of what was in the Shi'i prophecies, in the Shi'i traditions. And we can describe them as clinging on to the Shi'i catastrophic type of millennialism. They still believed that there would be some sort of military victory. And this group was led by Azim and had the support of Azal and was meeting at the house of Suleiman Khan, who was a leading courtier in Tehran, wealthy person, had a large house. His father had been in charge of the king's stables. And he himself was in court circles, and this group was meeting at his house. And the second group, who disowned violent action, who rather looked to the texts of the Bab that exhorted his followers to high ideals of virtue as a way of attracting people to the new religion, and maybe therefore said to be moved over to the progressive type of millennialism. And this group was led by Baha'u'llah and met in his house. So there were these two camps in Tehran in the early 1850. And the two events that shifted the balance among the Tehran Babis towards the catastrophic group, I think what I'll do is I'll just put up these names here, because I'm going to keep them going. So on this side there was Hazim. And the events that happened that shifted the balance away from those on the progressive towards the more catastrophic elements among the Babis in Tehran was the fact that the Prime Minister of the time exiled Baha'u'llah to Karbala, so in other words he removed Baha'u'llah from the scene. This happened in June 1851, and Baha'u'llah was in Karbala right through to May 1852. so this removal of the leader of this group shifted the balance towards the other group. And the second thing that happened was the arrival in Tehran of another important figure, which was Hossein Jadhemilani. Hossein Jadhemilani was a figure who had not been a Babi a long time. He had become a Babi only for a year before this. And he wasn't an educated man, he was a weaver, but he seems to have been a very compelling, charismatic type of personality. He arrived in Tehran and was initially living in a caravanserai outside the town, but he was introduced to Suleiman Khan, who had this large house in Tehran, and Suleiman Khan was very attracted to him and invited him to come to live in his house. And very soon this very charismatic figure was giving making major speeches and attracting large numbers of people to his house. And it was with the coming of, at about this time, whether it was directly caused by the coming of Hossein Jan or not, I don't know, but the removal of Baha'u'llah, the coming of Hossein Jan, all of these things seem to have turned people towards militancy, because at this time we hear that Azim and Azal began to talk about accumulating weapons, talk of revenge, and these sort of things started to come to the fore. And Azim wrote to a number of Babis in other parts of Iran asking them to come to Tehran and assist in these plans. And at the same time, Hossein Jan was whipping up enthusiasm for all of this by his oratory and by his skills in sort of with rousing the emotions of the Babis collected at Suleiman Khan's house. In Baha'u'llah, as I say, when we come to 1852, Baha'u'llah returned to Tehran in May 1852, but he was unable, and in these crucial 3 months just before August 1852, he was unable to re-establish his sort of previous authority in among the Babis of the town, because the prime minister of the time, by this time the previous prime minister Mirza Tahir Khan had been dismissed, and there was a new prime minister, Mirza Agha Khan. He was a Nuri, he was distantly related to Baha'u'llah and was from the same Nuri clan as Baha'u'llah. And it was he who had brought Baha'u'llah back from Iraq, but he was doing this really for his own reasons. He wanted to show the Shah that he had the Babi problem under control, and one of the ways of doing this was to have Baha'u'llah under his own personal control. So he made Baha'u'llah stay in his own house in Tehran, and in the summer, when the summer months arrived and it was customary for the nobility to withdraw to the cooler hills to the north of Tehran, he had Baha'u'llah go to his he kept Baha'u'llah in his brother's house in Tehran, but he had Baha'u'llah then move to his own estate at Afchen, to the north of Tehran. So Baha'u'llah was kept away from the Babis and therefore unable really to influence what was happening in these last 1 or 2 months before the attempt on the life of the Shah. So what was happening in these meetings that were being held in the house of Suleiman Khan? As I say, Hossein Jan was becoming more and more inflammatory in his speeches, and it's clear that he had really totally started to dominate this group of people. We're fortunate in having an account of what was happening from the brother of Baha'u'llah, Mirza Musa, who's known as Aghai Kalim. Mirza Musa was really part of this other progressive group. He was against all of the talk of militancy that was going on in Suleiman Khan's house. And on one occasion, just a few days before the attempt on the life of the Shah took place, he went to Suleiman Khan's house and tried to, in an attempt to calm things down and to talk them out of any militant action. And we have an account from him of what happened when he went to the house of Suleiman Khan. what happened initially was that he went to the door and the doorman didn't recognize him and turned him away. But then the people inside heard what had happened and sent someone to bring him back again. So he came back, and this is his own words, in his own words, what happened when he, what he found when he went into the meeting. He said, when we got permission to enter the meeting, we saw that Hossein, that's Hossein Jana Milani, was not the same Hossein of former days. His first words were an apology, i.e. about the previous fact that he'd been turned away from the door. Then he said, that which the primal point, i.e. the Bab, had forbidden, I have permitted. Now, in this group, there were some Qajar princes. There were quite notable people attending this group. There were about 70 people in this group of Babis who were meeting in Soleiman Khan's house. There were Qajar princes. There were members of the nobility and so on. And Akbar Mirza, who was one of these minor Qajar nobility, was there. Mirza Musa reports Akbar Mirza, the brother of Muhammad Hashem Mirza, a minor Qajar nobility, was there, and he was going along with them. Then a lengthy poem, which one of the people of Azerbaijan had composed in praise of Hossein, in Persian, Turkish, and Arabic, was read to the end in a joyful tone. Every time the name of Hossein was said, everyone prostrated themselves to him. I saw that some were looking at me angrily because I was not going along with them in their obsequiousness to Hussein. One of them seized the turban of Janab, who is this Muhammad Hashem Mirza, one of this Qajar, who had come along with Mirza Musa to this meeting. One of them seized the turban of him and cast it to the ground, saying, how long will you remain behind the veil of names and customs? I saw that this accusation was actually directed at me, so I asked Hossein Jan Milani, the Bab has prohibited prostrating oneself before another human being. Do you now enjoin it? This question put Hossein into deep thought. His head fell, and he said nothing. As I looked around the gathering, I saw they were all immersed in desires and passions, except for three people who were in a different state. They were disgusted at that worthless assembly and were like prisoners in thought of escape. And he says, one of them was Suleiman Khan, who was standing there distraught, and from time to time an involuntary movement could be seen in his limbs and he would shift his position. Another was Mirza Ahmad, who's the secretary of the Bab and who out of embarrassment was standing in a corner. And another was Mirza Abdul Wahhab Shirazi, who had followed Baha'u'llah from Iraq to Tehran. And when I saw those people was emotional and tearful, I saw that it would not be right to remain at this meeting. And so through a stratagem, I managed to extricate myself and the prince from there. So this is a report of what was going on at the meeting just 2 days before the attempt on the life of the Shah. And it's clear from this that even Suleiman Khan, who was later blamed as being the chief organizer of the attempt on the life of the Shah, even he had lost control of the meeting, and everything was being totally dominated by Hossein Jan, who was using his oratory and crowd manipulation skills to excite his audience and exalt his own leadership. Mirza Musa further recounts that this Azim, the following day, actually sought another meeting with Mirza Musa and had told Mirza Musa that he'd actually been chucked out of the meeting, and when he tried to stop Hossein Jan from proceeding with what he was planning. So it's clear that Hossein Jan, who was not a particularly educated literate or anything else, not an organizer at all in fact, had sort of keyed up everyone's emotions. And what appears to have happened is that he sort of sent out 12 people from this meeting to go to Shemran in the north of Tehran, where the Shah was staying. And of these 12, three then found the opportunity to make an attempt on the life of the Shah, but it was never a particularly serious attempt, not a well-conceived attempt, in that their guns, their pistols were loaded with grape shot, which would be very unlikely to kill anyone. And so the whole thing was rather badly planned by Hossein Jan, who was more of a sort of orator than a planner by all indications. And so the whole thing went awry and resulted in complete disaster for the Wahhabi movement. In that the Shah then gave orders for, first of all, two of the assassins were captured, tortured until they revealed who they were, and then a raid was made on the house of Sulaiman Khan, and 12 Wahhabis were captured there. And the servant of Sulaiman Khan was made to then go around Tehran identifying other Wahhabis who had come to the meetings at Sulaiman Khan's house, and these were arrested. And there was a general arresting of any Wahhabi who could be found anywhere in the country, and orders were put out for a general massacre of any Wahhabis who could be found. So the whole thing ended in disaster for the Wahhabis. Baha'u'llah himself was imprisoned. He was identified by the mother of the Shah as a key Wahhabi, and therefore she was very keen to have him killed. But he, because he had initially been found in the compound of the Russian minister, Baha'u'llah as being one of the people who had been at these meetings, and so he was eventually released and left exiled. So what I want to do quickly then in the last couple of minutes is to talk a little bit about the factors that led, as I say, from the situation in 1850, where the Wahhabis were basically only reacting to defending themselves when they were being attacked, to this episode. What were the factors that led this small group of Wahhabis in Tehran towards violence and towards this attempt on the life of the Shah? First of all, one factor to bear in mind is that it was just a small group, and it always is just a small group. I mean, if we look at these other episodes of violence that I mentioned at the beginning, Om Shinriko and so on, these were never, any of these episodes were not the whole group engaging in violence. It was always a small group within the following of that particular religious movement who go for the violence. Millennialist groups are not strange cults, as newspaper articles love to depict them. Neither are they socially marginal, nor are they psychologically maladjusted. There are a number of very well-defined situations in which millennialist groups who would normally be quite peaceful, because even the catastrophic types of millennialist groups believe that the catastrophe is going to be coming through a non-human agency. They don't consider themselves as being obliged to bring it about in any way. It's going to come, and they will be there and they will witness it, but they don't regard themselves as being the instigators of violence. So what is it that causes these normally peaceful millennialist groups, whether they're of the catastrophic or progressive type, to move towards violence? Those who have studied these have come up with a number of factors. First of all, they've divided the types of millennialist groups that go on to violence into three types. And of these, two of the types are relevant to the Wahhabis. The first is those groups who are assaulted and just have to defend themselves. And that group fits in with the Wahhabis in the period from 1848 to 1850. They were assaulted, they were attacked, and they defended themselves. So violence in that group is purely a reaction against being attacked. But the other group that she identifies, which I think is more relevant to the 1850 to 1852 situation, is that of the fragile group, where the leadership is fragmenting, the goals are slipping away from them, and they want to do something to realize their millennialist goal. Whereas previously they'd been content to just let it happen, and the understanding that it was going to happen through some external supernatural force coming in and causing things to change, as they see their goals slipping away from them, as they see, in effect, defeat staring them in the face, they start to try and themselves bring about this millennialist goal, and this attempt on the life of the Shah, I think, can be seen in that way. It was a last desperate attempt by a small faction of Barbies holding on to their vision of how things should have been, that the coming of the 12th Imam should have resulted in an apocalyptic battle, should have led to a military victory, and so on. They still had this Shi'i view of how things should be, and this was a last desperate attempt by them to realize that vision of what should have happened with the coming of the 12th Imam. The specific factors that we can identify that led these Babis to violence are persecution, which again can be seen in other millennialist groups that have turned to violence. The Branch Davidians in Waco, for example, became violent when they were persecuted. Aum Shinriko began their violent actions when they were persecuted and being attacked. The second factor is the conceptual factor, which is this radical, what you might call radical dualism, the seeing the world in terms of evil and good. This happened, for example, looking back to past other examples, the Taborite wing of the Hussites in Bohemia began to see themselves as the elect and everyone else as being the damned, and so justified violence towards others by this sort of vision of themselves as the forces of good and others as the forces of evil. And as I say, in the case of the Babis, there was this vision of themselves as the people who were on the side of the Imam, and therefore automatically their enemies were the return of the persecutors of the Imam, who that fact in itself warranted being violent, being attacking them. The third factor that's been identified in other millennialist groups that have turned to violence is the charismatic leadership that is required to take people across, if you like, across this gulf where normally people refrain from violence, but to sort of carry them over that bridge. A very charismatic leader will take people into this area where they would normally not go. This occurred, for example, in other examples, in the case of Aum Shinriko, where the leader, as it were, was able to persuade his followers to move into this phase of violence. And in this case, Hossein Jana Milani appears to have been a very charismatic leader that was able to take people along with him into this violent phase. And the fourth factor that's been identified in terms of other groups that have turned to violence, and I think can also be seen in the case of the Babis, is the fact that there was a general, Norman Cohn, for example, who's described millennialism in the Middle Ages, talks about the social and economic dislocations that were happening in the traditional structures of Europe in the Middle Ages, and which then was the milieu out of which militant millennialism emerged. And Iran can similarly be seen in the period that we're examining as a society, in a period of rapid social change, economic change and dislocation. The traditional society of Iran, and particularly its traditional crafts and industries, were being assailed by the economic superiority of the West, and there was this sort of general sense of economic dislocation and social dislocation going on. So in summary then, what I've tried to show is the way in which a small faction of the Babis, a mere 70 people at the most, turned from the usual Pacific stance of millennialism, the normal type of millennialism, which is quite content to let events unfold, towards violence. And that the main factors appear to have been the severe previous persecution of the Babis that fragmented the group and caused them to want to do something radical to change things around, the doctrinal elements of the radical dualism of seeing the world in terms of black and white, of light and dark, of forces of evil and good, and the factor of this of a charismatic leader that was able to take his followers across this bridge towards violence. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for a very illuminating lecture. To me, it was had a few new aspects that I, as far as I know, Qajar history wasn't. I didn't know this side. I understand this is a new research, so it's not something that I didn't read before. I take the right of a chairman to maybe put the first question, but then you have the rights to, of course, to ask others. Could you elaborate a little bit on the sources? I mean, it, since I didn't encounter this, it very much interests me about the sources that.
Most of the material is there implicitly. If you look very carefully at Nabil's narrative, for example, you find that this split between the more pacific group led by Baha'u'llah and the more militant group led by Azim is there. We find, for example, that when Baha'u'llah came back from Karbala to, and as I say, was being held by the Prime Minister of the time, Mirza Agha Khan, in his own home, and then he was transferred to Afjar. There's a passage in Nabil's narrative saying that as he was being moved, so in other words, roughly about June 1852, just 2 months before the attempt took place, he met with Azim, and it says there that he tried to persuade him against the course of action that he was taking, clearly indicating that even at that time, 2 months beforehand, there were plans to do something or other. accounts of the struggle between between Azim and the blind Indian Sayyid Basir Ahendi is there in the new history, and in it's there also even in Nabil's narrative. It's much clearer, the actual contest and so on is clearer in Tariq al-Jadid. And there's a wide variety of sources that bring out this whole element. There's also the document that I translated and read out was in the history Tariq al-Zuhur al-Haq of Fazil al-Mazandarani. And then I used what other sources are there? Those are the main sources that I was using.
This brings me to ask another question.
The other sources are the actual reports in the Ruznameh Vagaye Etefabiyeh that actually reports the episode and reports the interrogation of the people and what they said, the Babis reports their interrogation and what they said and so on.
Yes, I will... No, it's okay. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for you said that reach progressive billion galleries.